Welcome to episode 8 of Pints and Puzzles. Tonight's episode is the first in a series of semi-related shows with a possible bonus episode put in there just for you guys. Speaking of bonuses, I have two for you right now. As you all know, I'm an avid listener of podcasts, and I'm not shy about recommending ones that you may enjoy. Here's a treat, though. Rather than me going on about how awesome these podcasts are, I'm going to let them speak for themselves.
Hey guys, it's Lainey, host of the True Crime Fan Club podcast. If you're a true crime addict like I am, then my podcast is for you. It's a podcast for the ultimate true crime enthusiast, giving you a glimpse into the life and crimes of the most demented minds. You won't want to miss an episode.
True Crime Fan Club goes deep into the darkness while still keeping it above board. It's a very well-researched, well-hosted, and produced show, so definitely give it a listen if that's your thing. The second is a brand new podcast that I'm really excited to dive into. You may recognize some of the names, and hell, you may even recognize the host. All of you really do need to subscribe to Convicted. But hey, don't take my word for it.
You've heard the names before. Daryl Massey, Fred Hanna, Christina Gutierrez. You know the location.
The arrest began this morning of about a dozen Baltimore City police officers.
But have you heard this name?
This call is from
Richard Nicholas,
an inmate at a Maryland correctional facility. This call will be recorded and monitored.
A 2-year-old girl was murdered.
From moment one, she just laughed and smiled. She was a beautiful baby. And nothing mattered but getting to know her. And she was just like a ray of light. I mean, she was just a breath of fresh air. She was just, oh my God, she was like an angel.
And her father was convicted. Did you kill her?
No, I did not. I did not shoot my daughter.
Subscribe now to Convicted, coming late April. More information at convictedpod.com.
And episode 1 either is or will be, depending on when you're listening to this, out on April 24th of 2017. So enjoy that. While we're on the topic of podcasts, any fans of the podcast Tannis or Astonishing Legends know one of the strangest areas of the country is what's commonly referred to as the Pacific Northwest region of the United States. And let me just say, there's plenty of material to do future episodes on this area. However, my research team, which consists of my wife and immediate family, small operation here, folks, pointing me a little further north to, of all places, Alaska. So tonight's episode will be the first of at least 2 episodes looking at strange events from up that way. Open up a warming beverage of your choice, and let's take a look at the vanishing natives of Nome, Alaska.
What's a podcast? Find me a podcast. You're listening to Hear Me Listening to My Dad. What the show is best?
The town of Nome, Alaska is located just off the Bering Sea and is home to just over 3,500 residents. While nothing really jumps out at me from a purely historical standpoint, it is home to the popular TV show Bering Sea Gold, so it has that going for it. Now, the reason it came onto the Pints and Puzzles radar was the odd disappearance of 24 people from that town between 1960 and 2004. I'd be willing to wager that most of you all listening have a fun conspiratorial mind with the gears turning when you hear about disappearances in a relatively remote town. And we weren't the only ones with such creative ideas. In 2009, Universal Pictures created and released a movie called The Fourth Kind. So this was a Blair Witch-style, lost footage-type movie that focused on a doctor who had patients who all had similar missing time stories. The summary goes like this, quote, They hear violent sounds outside their room, followed by someone or something dragging them out of their bed against their will as they scream and howl in protest. Then they black out. The psychiatrist in the movie feels these are encounters of the third kind. Okay, patent and tangent time. Most of you have probably heard the different kinds of encounters, or at least have heard of the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind. So these encounter kinds actually come from a 1972 book from J. Allen Hynek, which was titled The UFO Experience, A Scientific Inquiry. Interestingly, Dr. Hynek originally worked with the Air Force to essentially debunk most of the UFO claims from a scientific perspective. His views gradually changed over time, basically due to the cocky attitude the scientific and military communities had towards UFOs, as well as the increased credibility of witnesses that were starting to come forward. In part, Hynek stated, quote, "Ridicule is not part of scientific method, and people should not be taught that it is. The steady flow of reports, often made in concert by reliable observers, raises questions of scientific obligation and responsibility." Anyway, I find his story particularly interesting, being that he's a respected scientist whose views changed the more he learned about the UFO phenomenon. Nonetheless, it was Hynek who developed the Close Encounter Scale. Again, for reference, this was mentioned in the 1972 book that Hynek wrote. So, close encounters of the first kind are visual sightings of unidentified flying objects seemingly less than 500 feet away that show an appreciable angular extension and considerable detail. So this is probably the most common in that you get a visual sighting of the object. Close encounters of the second kind are a UFO event in which a physical effect is alleged. This can be inference from the functioning of a vehicle or electronic device, animals reacting, a physiological effect such as paralysis or heat and discomfort in the witness, or some physical trace like impressions in the ground, scorched or otherwise affected vegetation, or a chemical trace. So this is where the UFO not only was seen, but it actually has some kind of effect on either the surrounding area or another living element in there. Close encounters of the third kind are UFO encounters in which animated creature is present. And this includes humanoids, robots, and humans who seem to be occupants or pilots of a UFO. This is the most extreme kind where you actually see an alien being along with the UFO or craft. And there's a lot of varieties in the subcategories here to add to Hynek's scale that vary on to where the entity is in relation to the UFO. And there have been other additions to this scale throughout the years. I think there's actually 6 categories now. However, these were the 3 original categories and probably the most relevant and popular ones to this date. So, tangents aside, the movie The Fourth Kind was all about these close encounters of the third kind. But unfortunately, as it relates to the disappearances of the people in Nome, Alaska, the movie is as far as things got. Most of the 2009 research into the lost footage and fact portion of the film led to various fake news reports that were actually created by Universal Pictures. So this was legitimate fake news before that was a very overused term nowadays. It actually got to the point where the Alaska Press Club sued Universal and won a settlement of $20,000 for the fake news, also forced to remove all that from the internet. Bottom line is there were some actual disappearances up in Nome, Alaska during that time frame. And what I call promotional materials for the movies may have distracted from the reality in some cases. So we'll take a look at some of these disappearances as well as some of the reality behind it right after a break. Being that we are now well into episode 8, you're all very aware of our partner sponsor, Fulton for Life. So with Mother's Day around the corner, I'd strongly encourage you all to check out their offerings over at fultonforlife.com. And of course, use promo codes PINTS at checkout for a discount. Other than being my wife's company, one of the main reasons I love Fulton is that it's a small family-run business. One other family-run business that I'd encourage you all to check out is Addicting Pretzels. Owners Tom and Sherry are listeners of the show and very generously sent me some of their pretzels to try out. Now, despite the fact that I will certainly work for pretzels, they are not official sponsors of the show. However, I do love these pretzels, and they're not only addictive, but they really are amazing. They have a variety of sizes and flavors to suit everyone's taste. My personal favorites are the ranch and buffalo ranch, my wife loves the cinnamon sugar ones, and my kids actually love the chipotle flavor. So I strongly encourage you all to check out their website at addictingpretzels.com and order a few bags to try out for yourself. There's no promo code, but hey, feel free to tell them that you heard it on Pints and Puzzles. Again, you're supporting another small family-run business that happens to be a member of the Pints and Puzzles army, for lack of a better term. So that's FultonForLife.com for Mother's Day gifts and AddictingPretzels.com for delicious treats. So despite the Hollywood element, the fact of the matter is there really have been at least 24 missing persons from Nome, Alaska between 1960 and 2004. A bit of digging on the popular missing persons site CharlieProject.org does in fact show a bunch of open cases from Nome in that particular time frame. Some of which were summarized from a 2009 article in the Anchorage Daily News, which I'm going to read just a couple excerpts from here. The first was Myra Henry, who got involved after her brother-in-law, Archie Henry Jr., disappeared on a shopping trip to Nome in 1998. And for a year, she called the Nome Police daily, turning up several potential witnesses herself, but the case never went anywhere. She also had a cousin who disappeared from Nome in 1987, coming home from Anchorage after leaving his hotel to get a few drinks. One of the more talked-about disappearances was that of Eric Apotiki. Now, Eric disappeared in 2004 after being involved in multiple altercations, and he seemingly disappeared. After a few days of searching the surrounding area, including the gold ponds and jetties, the police found no trace of either Eric or anything that may have happened to him. Either way, no one came up with anything, and the police only came to the basic conclusion that he just walked off. So these are just a few of the examples of the 24 missing people, and I think instead of our typical theory section, we're going to talk about some of the, at least to me, some of the factors that could contribute to some of these disappearances. And the first of these is something that is near and dear to the show, alcohol. One of the important things to note here is Nome is one of the quote-unquote wet towns in the area, and many of the surrounding towns and areas are dry or unable to serve alcohol. So oftentimes people will travel to the bars on Front Street and have drinks and then travel home. Because it's usually not a local distance to travel to get home, this could increase the chances of something happening, either getting lost in the elements or running into foul play between where they're leaving their drinks for the night and their commute home, so to speak. Of course, when there's too much alcohol consumed, you inevitably run into the second factor that plays a role in here, the police. In Nome specifically, there seems to be a cultural level of distrust between the native population and the police. Throughout the years, there have been various complaints of mistreatment by the police, including allegations that the police have driven drunks out into the cold to walk off their inebriation. Let me be clear here. These are just tangential allegations, for the most part. There was one incident of a Nome police officer, Matthew Owens, who was charged with the murder of a local high school student. The initial trial for Owens ended in a hung jury. However, there was a subsequent trial that resulted in a guilty verdict. I do realize that this is just one example and likely not the norm. However, as it relates to the disappearances, it seems to add fuel to the already burning fire of distrust between both sides and could definitely contribute to the native population's reluctance to ask the Nome police for help. The police mistrust was definitely not a secret issue by any means and was likely a contributing factor in the FBI eventually looking into these disappearances. So what did the FBI conclude? Well, three of the families asked the cases to be left alone, Two were criminal cases that were prosecuted and convicted. One was a snowmobile accident, and nine others were found by the police chief at the time to have, quote, definitive outcomes, mostly involving alcohol, end quote. So that said, there's still nine others that remained opened and unsolved. And just for you true crime fans, they did conclude there was no evidence to support a serial killer in the area. So what do I think happened here? Well, I think two things. As far as the movie goes, I think that A, discounted real abductions from aliens that may or may not have happened in that area. So that's a problem in and of itself. B, it also took away from the real missing persons and people taking that part of it seriously. As far as what do I think happened to the 24 missing people, or at least the 9 that are unsolved? Well, unfortunately, I think that Occam's razor comes into play here, where the most simple or straightforward hypothesis or conclusion is probably the most accurate one here, where they just were victims of the elements or disappeared due to one of those factors rather than foul play. The reason I think this is because of the remoteness of the area, you have the weather conditions, there's a bunch of cultural issues there, and also the fact that Nome is one of the few towns where you can actually get alcohol. I think that all these factors, to me at least, play a role into some of the disappearances here. I do think it's also important to note that if you wanted to disappear, that Nome may not be a bad place to do that as well, due to the remoteness and some of those factors that we talked about just a couple seconds ago. Lastly, as far as the UFOs go, there are quite a significant amount of UFO sightings from up in the Alaska region in general, but I absolutely would not completely downplay that side of things, at least in my head. And also, if you want some fun research, feel free to Google the Alaska Triangle, and you can look up all sorts of fun, crazy, paranormal things that happen up that way. I think that'll wrap up tonight's episode. I thank you, as always, for taking a few minutes out of your day or night or whenever you're listening to this to hang out with us. I know this episode was slightly different than normal as far as formatting goes, but I hope you enjoyed it either way. As always, be sure to head on over to fultonforlife.com to get the special mom in your life an amazing Mother's Day gift, and be sure to order some addicting pretzels to go with our next podcast listening session. Our beer review is on the way. Don't forget to tip your servers. Have a great night. Tonight's beer review comes from the great folks over at Left Hand Brewing, and it's the Hardwired Nitro Coffee Porter. Say that 5 times fast. It's a 6% alcohol, 33% IBU, and this one is completely counterintuitive to the other stouts in that the cap and label both say serve cold, pour hard. So they want you to serve it cold, which is slightly counterintuitive for most stouts, even though I do like almost all my beers served probably colder than an average beer connoisseur, so to speak, would like to drink them. But the strange thing is that you really do have to flip it upside down as fast as you can just to get a perfect pour from this beer. This has mostly to do with the nitrogen that's in it, and the bottle doesn't have a widget like the Guinness bottles usually do. Some of the Guinness bottles do. But it does give you a similar effect. The beer itself is what I really like here. It has one of the stronger coffee flavors, which I love, but it's still not an overly thick or overly heavy beer. The official website says toffee, which I can get, and some light hint of blueberry. Honestly, I got that, but only after I read it, so take that for what it's worth. Overall, this is definitely my current favorite in the dark coffee beer category. I do wish it had a little bit more carbonation, but the nitro in there is really nice and keeps the whole thing really smooth and very easy drinking. I don't know if it's the nitrogen or what, but you don't seem to get that bitter aftertaste that you do in most stouts or darker beers. This one's fairly widely available, so definitely check it out and let me know what you think, if coffee beers are your thing. And that'll do it for us for the evening, so thanks for checking us out, and I will talk to you in a few more weeks.
that was pretty awesome. That was totes amazing. Wowers. That's really great.